Chapter 11. Kenzo Isozaki could say honestly that he had never been afraid before in his life. Raised as a business samurai in the Fern Islands of Fuji, he had been taught and trained since infancy to be disdainful of fear and contemptuous of anyone who felt it. Caution he allowed. It had become an indispensable business tool for him. But fear was alien to his nature and his carefully constructed personality. Until this moment. M. Isozaki stood back while the inner door of the airlock cycled open. Whatever awaited within had been on the surface of an airless, tumbling asteroid a minute earlier, and it was not wearing a spacesuit. Isozaki had chosen not to bring a weapon on the little asteroid hopper. Neither he nor the ship was armed. At this moment, as ice crystals billowed like fog from the opening airlock and a humanoid figure stepped through, Kenzo Isozaki wondered if that had been a wise choice. The humanoid figure was human, or at least human in appearance. Tan skin, neatly cut gray hair, a perfectly tailored gray suit, gray eyes under lashes still rimmed with frost, and a white smile. "M. Isozaki?" said Counselor Albedo. Isozaki bowed. He had brought his heart rate and breathing under his control, and now he concentrated on keeping his voice flat, level, and emotionless. "It's kind of you to respond to my invitation." Albedo crossed his arms. The smile remained on the tanned, handsome face, but Isozaki was not fooled by it. The seas around the Fern Islands of Fuji were thick with sharks descended from the DNA recipes and frozen embryos of the early Bussard seed ships. "Invitation?" said Counselor Albedo in a rich voice. "Or summons?" Isozaki's head remained slightly bowed. His hands hung loosely at his sides.
"Never a summons, M."
"You know my name, I think," said Albedo.
"The rumors say that you are the same Counselor Albedo who advised Mayna Gladstone almost 3 centuries ago, sir," said the CEO of the Pax Mercantilis.
"I was more hologram than substance then," said Albedo, uncrossing his arms. "But the personality is the same. And you need not call me sir."
Isozaki bowed slightly.
Counselor Albedo stepped deeper into the little hopper. He ran his powerful fingers over consoles and the single pilot's couch and the rim of its empty high-G tank. "A modest ship for such a powerful person, M. Isozaki."
"I thought it best to exercise discretion, Counselor. May I call you that?"
Instead of answering, Albedo took an aggressive step closer to the CEO. Isozaki did not flinch. "Did you feel it an act of discretion to release an AI viral telotaxis into Pachem's crude datasphere so that it could go looking for technocore nodes?" Albedo's voice filled the hopper cabin. Kenzo Isozaki raised his eyes to meet the gray glare of the taller man.
"Yes, Counselor.
If the Corps still existed, it was imperative that the Mercantilis make personal contact. The telotaxis was programmed to self-destruct if detected by PAC's antiviral programs, and to inoculate only if it received an unmistakable Corps response." Counselor Albedo laughed. "Your AI telotaxis was about as subtle as the metaphorical turd in the proverbial punch bowl, Isozaki-san." The Mercantilis CEO blinked in surprise at the crudity. Albedo dropped into the acceleration couch, stretched, and said,
"Sit down, my friend. You went to all that trouble to find us. You risked torture, excommunication, real execution, and the loss of your parking privileges in the Vatican skimmer park. You want to talk? Talk."
Temporarily off balance, Isozaki looked for another surface on which to sit. He settled on a clear section of the plotting board. He disliked zero-G, so the crude internal containment field kept up a differential simulating one gravity. But the effect was inconsistent enough to keep Isozaki teetering on the edge of vertigo. He took a breath and gathered his thoughts.
"You are serving the Vatican," he began.
Albedo interrupted at once. The Corps serves no one, mercantilist man.
Isozaki took another breath and began again. Your interests and the Vatican's have overlapped to the point that the Techno-Corps provides counsel and technology vital to the survival of the Pax.
Counselor Albedo smiled and waited.
Thinking, for what I will say next, His Holiness will feed me to the Grand Inquisitor. I will be on the pain machine for 100 lifetimes, Isozaki said. Some of us within the Executive Council of the Pan-Capitalist League of Independent Catholic Transstellar Trade Organizations feel that the interests of the League and the interests of the Techno-Corps may well hold more in common than those of the Corps and the Vatican. We feel that an investigation of those common goals and interests would be beneficial to both parties.
Counselor Albedo showed more of his perfect teeth. He said nothing. Feeling the hemp-like texture of the noose he was placing around his own neck, Isozaki said,
For 2¾ centuries, the Church and the Pax civil authorities have held as official policy that the Techno-Corps was destroyed in the fall of the Farcasters. Millions of those close to power on worlds across Pax space know the rumors of the Corps' survival.
The rumors of our death are greatly exaggerated, said Counselor Albedo. So?
So, continued Isozaki, with the full understanding that this alliance between Corps personalities and the Vatican has been beneficial to both parties, Counselor. The League would like to suggest ways in which a similar direct alliance with our trading organization would bring more immediate and tangible benefits to your society.
Suggest away, Isozaki-san, said Counselor Albedo, leaning farther back in the pilot's chair.
One, said Isozaki, his voice growing firmer. The Pax Mercantilis is expanding in ways which no religious organization can hope to do, however hierarchical or universally accepted it might be. Capitalism is regaining power throughout the Pax. It is the true glue that holds the hundreds of worlds together. Two, the Church continues to carry on its endless war with the Ousters and with rebellious elements within the Pax sphere of influence. The Pax Mercantilis views all such conflicts as a waste of energy and precious human and material resources. More importantly, it involves the Techno-Corps in human squabbles that can neither further Corps interests nor advance Corps goals. 3. While the Church and the Pax utilize such obviously Corps-derived technologies as the instantaneous Gideon Drive and the Resurrection Creches, the Church gives the Techno-Corps no credit for these inventions. Indeed, the Church still holds the Corps up as an enemy to its billions of faithful, portraying the Corps entities as having been destroyed because they were in league with the devil. The Pax Mercantilis has no need for such prejudice and artifice. If the Corps were to choose continued concealment when allied with us, we should honor that policy, always willing to present the Corps as visible and appreciated partners when and if you should so decide. In the meantime, however, the League would move to end, for now and forever, the demonization of the Techno-Corps in history, lore, and the minds of human beings everywhere.
Counselor Albedo looked thoughtful. After a moment of gazing out the port at the tumbling asteroid beyond, he said, So you will make us rich and respectable?
Kenzo Isozaki said nothing. He felt that his future and the balance of power in human space was teetering on a knife's edge. He could not read Albedo. The cybrid's sarcasm could well be a prelude to negotiation.
What would we do with the Church? Asked Albedo. More than 2½ human centuries of silent partnership.
Isozaki willed his heart rate to slow again. We do not wish to interrupt any relationship which the Corps has found useful or profitable, he said softly. As business people, we in the League are trained to see the limitations of any religion-based interstellar society. Dogma and hierarchy are endemic to such structures. Indeed, such are the structures of any theocracy. As business people dedicated to the mutual profit of ourselves and our business associates, we see ways in which a second level of core human cooperation, however secretive or limited, should and would be beneficial to both parties. Counselor Albedo nodded again.
Isozaki-san, do you remember in your private office in the Taurus, when you had your associate, Anna Pelli Cognani, remove her clothes?
Isozaki retained a neutral expression, but only by the utmost effort of will. The fact that the Corps was looking into his private office, recording every transaction, made his blood literally chill.
You asked then, continued Albedo, why we had helped the Church refine the cruciform. To what ends, I believe you said, what is the benefit to the Corps?
Isozaki watched the man in gray. But more than ever he felt that he was locked in the little asteroid hopper with a cobra that had reared up and opened its hood.
"Have you ever owned a dog, Isozaki-san?" asked Albedo.
Still thinking about cobras, the mercantilist CEO could only stare.
"A dog?" he said after a moment.
"No, not personally. Dogs were not common on my home world."
"Ah, that's right," said Albedo, showing his white teeth again. "Sharks were the pet of choice on your island. I believe that you had a baby shark which you tried to tame when you were about 6 standard years old. You named it Keigo, if I am not mistaken."
Isozaki could not have spoken if his life had depended upon it at that second.
"And how did you keep your growing baby shark from eating you when you swam together in the Shioko Lagoon, Isozaki-san?"
After a moment of trying, Isozaki managed. "Caller."
"I beg your pardon?"
Counselor Albedo leaned closer.
"Caller,"
said the CEO. Small, perfectly black spots were dancing in the periphery of his vision.
"Shock caller.
We had to carry the transmitter palm keys, the same devices our fishermen used."
"Ah, yes," said Albedo, still smiling. "If your pet did something naughty, you brought it back into line, with just a touch of your finger."
He held his hand out, cupping it as if he were cradling an invisible palm key. His tanned finger came down on an invisible button. It was not so much like an electrical shock passing through Kenzo Isozaki's body, more like radiating waves of pure, unadulterated agony. Beginning in his chest, beginning in the cruciform embedded under his skin and flesh and bone, and radiating out like telegraph signals of pain, flowing through the hundreds of meters of fibers and nematodes and clustered nodes of cruciform tissue, metastasized through his body like rooted tumors. Isozaki screamed and doubled over in pain. He collapsed to the floor of the hopper.
"I believe that your palm keys could give old Keigo increasing jolts if he got aggressive," mused Counselor Albedo. "Wasn't that the case, Isozaki-san?"
His fingers tapped at empty air again, as if cueing a palm key. The pain grew worse. Isozaki urinated in his ship suit and would have voided his bowels if they had not been already empty. He tried to scream again, but his jaws clamped tight as if from violent tetanus. Enamel on his teeth cracked and chipped away. He tasted blood as he bit through a corner of his tongue.
"On a scale of 10, that would have been about a 2 for old Keigo, I think," said Counselor Albedo.
He stood and walked to the airlock, tapping the cycling combination in. Writhing on the floor, his body and brain useless appendages to a cruciform of horrific pain radiating through his body. Isozaki tried to scream through his locked jaws. His eyes were swelling out of their sockets. Blood ran from his nose and ears. Finished with cycling the airlock combination, Counselor Albedo tapped at the invisible key in his palm once again. The pain vanished. Isozaki vomited across the deck plates. Every muscle in his body twitched randomly while his nerves seemed to misfire.
"I will bring your proposal to the three elements of the Techno Corps," Counselor Albedo said formally. The proposition will be discussed and considered most seriously. In the meantime, my friend, your discretion will be counted upon."
Isozaki tried to make an intelligible noise, but he could only curl up and retch on the metal floor. To his horror, his spasming bowels were passing wind in a ripple of flatulence.
"And there will be no more AI viral telotaxis released in anyone's datasphere, will there, Isozaki-san?"
Albedo stepped into the airlock and cycled the door shut. Outside the port, the slashed rock of the unnamed asteroid tumbled and spun in dynamics known only to the gods of chaos mathematics. It took Radamanth Nemes and her three siblings only a few minutes to fly the dropship from Pax Base Bombacino to the village of Lockchild Lamond on the slate-dry world of Vitus Gray Valianus B. But the trip was complicated by the presence of three military skimmers that meddling fool Commander Solznikov had sent along in escort. Nemes knew from the secure tight-beam traffic between the base and the skimmers that the base commander had sent his aide, the bumbling Colonel Venara, to take personal charge of the expedition. More than that, Nemes knew that the colonel would be in charge of nothing. That is, Venara would be so wired with real-time holosim pickups and tight-beam squirters that Solznikov would be in actual command of the Pax troopers without showing his jowled face again. By the time they were hovering over the proper village, although village seemed too formal a term for the four-tiered strip of adobe houses that ran along the west side of the river, just as hundreds of other homes had for almost the entire way between the base and here, the skimmers had caught up and were spiraling in for a landing while Nemes looked for a site large enough and firm enough to hold the dropship. The doors of the adobe homes were painted bright primary colors. People on the street wore robes of the same hue. Nemes knew the reason for this display of color. She had accessed both their ship's memory and the encrypted Bombacino files on the Spectrum Helix people. The data was interesting only in that it suggested that these human oddities were slow to convert to the cross, slower still to submit to Pax control. Likely, in other words, to help a rebellious child, man, and one-armed android hide from the authorities. The skimmers landed on the dike road bordering the canal. Nemes brought the dropship down in a park, partially destroying an artesian well. Gyges shifted in his co-pilot seat and raised an eyebrow. "Scylla and Briareus will go out to make the formal search," Nemes said aloud. "You stay here with me." She had noted with no pride or vanity that her clone siblings had long since submitted to her authority, despite the death threat they had brought from the Three Elements and the certainty of it being carried out if she were to fail again. The other female and male went down the ramp and through the crowd of brightly robed people. Troopers in combat armor, visors sealed, jogged to meet them. Watching on the common optic channel, not via tight beam or vid pickup, Nemes recognized Colonel Venara's voice through his helmet speaker.
"The mayor, a woman named Cess Gia, refuses permission for us to search the houses."
Nemes could see Briaris's contemptuous smile reflected on the colonel's polished visor. It was like looking at a reflection of herself with slightly stronger bone structure.
"And you allow this mayor to dictate to you?" said Briareus.
Colonel Venara raised a gauntleted hand.
"The Pax recognizes the indigenous authorities until they have become part of the Pax protectorate," Scylla said.
"You said that Dr. Molina left a Pax trooper as guard."
Venara nodded. His breathing was amplified through the morphic amber helmet.
"There is no sign of that trooper. We have attempted to establish communication since we left Bombacino."
"Doesn't this trooper have a trace chip surgically implanted?" said Scylla.
"No, it is woven into his impact armor."
"And?"
"We found the armor in a well several streets over," said Colonel Venara.
Scylla's voice remained level.
"I presume the trooper was not in the armor."
"No," said the colonel, "just the armor and helmet. There was no body in the well."
"Pity," said Scylla. She started to turn away, but then looked back at the pack's colonel.
Just armor, you say? No weapon?
No. Venara's voice was gloomy. I've ordered a search of the streets, and we will question the citizens until someone volunteers the location of the house where the missing spacer was put under arrest by Dr. Molina. Then we will surround it and demand the surrender of all inside. I have, requested the civil courts in Bombacino consider our request for a search warrant. Briareus said,
Good plan, Colonel. If the glaciers don't arrive first and cover the village before the warrant is issued.
Glaciers? Said Colonel Venara.
Never mind, said Scylla. If it is acceptable to you, we shall help you search the adjoining streets and await proper authorization for a house-to-house search. To Nemes, she broadcast on the internal band. Now what?
Stay with him and do just what you offered, sent Nemes. Be courteous and law-abiding. We don't want to find Endymion or the girl with these idiots around. Gyges and I will go to Fast Time.
Good hunting, sent Briareus.
Gyges was already waiting at the dropship lock. Nemes said,
I'll take the town. You move downriver to the Farcaster Arch, and make sure that nothing gets through, going upriver or down, without your checking it out. Phase down to send a squirt message, and I'll shift periodically to check the band. If you find him or the girl, ping me.
It was possible to communicate via common band while phase shifted, but the energy expenditure was so horribly high, above and beyond the unimaginable energy needed just for the phase shift, that it was infinitely more economical to shift down at intervals to check the common band. Even a ping alarm would use the equivalent of this world's entire energy budget for a year. Gyges nodded, and the two phase shifted in unison, becoming chrome sculptures of a naked male and female. Outside the lock, the air seemed to thicken and the light deepen. Sound ceased. Movement stopped. Human figures became slightly out-of-focus statues, with their wind-rippled robes stiff and frozen like the trappings on bronze sculptures. Nemes did not understand the physics of phase shifting. She did not have to understand it in order to use it. She knew that it was neither the anti-entropic nor hyper-entropic manipulation of time, although the future UI had both of those seemingly magical technologies at its command, nor some sort of speeding up that would have had sonic booms crashing and the air temperature boiling in their wake. But that phase shifting was a sort of sidestepping into the hollowed-out boundaries of space-time.
You will become, in the nicest sense, rats scurrying in the walls of the rooms of time, had said the core entity most responsible for her creation.
Nemes was not offended by the comparison. She knew the unimaginable amounts of energy that had to be transferred from the core via the void which binds to her or her siblings when they phase shifted. The elements had to respect even their own instruments to divert so much energy in their direction. The two reflective figures jogged down the ramp and went opposite directions. Gyges south toward the Farcaster, Nemes past her frozen siblings and the sculptures of Pax troopers and Spectrum citizens into the Adobe City. It took her literally no time at all to find the house with the handcuffed Pax trooper asleep in the corner bedroom facing the canal. She rummaged through the downloaded Pax Base Bombacino files to identify the sleeping trooper, a Lusian named Garen Potts, 38 standard years old, a lazy, initiative-free alcohol addict, 2 years away from retirement, 6 demotions and 3 sentences to brig time in his file, assignments relegated to garrison duty and the most mundane base tasks. And then she deleted the file. The trooper was of no interest to her. Checking once to make sure that the house was empty, Radamanth Nemes dropped out of phase shift and stood a moment in the bedroom. Sound and movement returned. The snoring of the handcuffed trooper, movement of pedestrians along the canal walk, a soft breeze stirring white curtains, the rumble of distant traffic, and even the samurai armor rustles of the Pax troopers jogging through adjoining streets and alleys in their useless search.
Standing over the pack's trooper, Nemes extended her hand and first finger, as if pointing at the man's neck. A needle emerged from under her fingernail and extended the 10 centimeters to the sleeping man's neck, sliding under the skin and flesh with only the slightest speck of blood to show the intrusion. The trooper did not wake. Nemes withdrew the needle and examined the blood within. Dangerous levels of C27H45OH. Lusians frequently were at risk from high cholesterol, as well as a low platelet count, suggesting the presence of incipient immune thrombocytopenic purpura, probably brought about by the trooper's early years in hard radiation environments on any of several garrison worlds. A blood alcohol level of 122 milligrams over 100 milliliters. The trooper was drunk, although his alcoholic past probably allowed him to hide most of the effects. And voila! The presence of the artificial opiate called Ultramorph, mixed with heightened levels of caffeine. Nemes smiled. Someone had drugged the trooper with sleep-inducing amounts of Ultramorph mixed with tea or coffee, but had done so while taking care to keep the levels below a dangerous overdose. She sniffed the air. Nemes's ability to detect and identify distinct airborne organic molecules, that is, her sense of smell, was about 3 times more sensitive than a typical gas chromatograph mass spectrometer's. In other words, somewhere above that of the old Earth canine called a bloodhound. The room was filled with the distinctive scents of many people. Some of the smells were old, a few were very recent. She identified the Lusian trooper's alcoholic stink, several subtle, musky female scents, the molecular imprint of at least 2 children, one deeply into puberty and the other younger but afflicted with some cancer requiring chemotherapy, and 2 adult males, one bearing the distinct sweat impressions of the diet of this planet, the other being at once familiar and alien. Alien, because the man still carried the scent of a world Nemes had never visited. Familiar, because it was the distinctive human smell she had filed away. Rawl Endymion still carrying the scent of old Earth with him. Nemes walked from room to room, but there was no hint of the peculiar scent she had encountered 4 years earlier of the girl named Anea, nor the antiseptic android smell of the servant called Abetic. Only Rawl Endymion had been here, but he had been here only moments before. Nemes followed the scent trail to the trap door beneath the hall flooring. Ripping the door open despite its multiple locks, she paused before descending the ladder. She squirted the information on the common band, not receiving a responding ping from Gyges, who was probably phase-shifted. It had been only 90 seconds since they had left the ship. Nemes smiled. She could ping Gyges, and he would be here before Rawl Endymion and the others in the tunnel below had taken another 10 heartbeats. But Radamanth Nemes would like to settle this score alone. Still smiling, she jumped into the hole and dropped 8 meters to the tunnel floor below. The tunnel was lighted. Nemes sniffed the cool air, separating the adrenaline-rich scent of Rawl Endymion from the other human odors. The Hyperion-born fugitive was nervous, and he had been ill or injured. Nemes picked up the underlying smell of sweat tinged with Ultramorph. Endymion had certainly been the off-worlder treated by Dr. Molina, and someone had used painkillers prescribed for him on the hapless Lusian trooper. Nemes phase-shifted and began jogging down a tunnel now filled with thickened light. No matter how much of a head start Endymion and his allies had on her, she would catch them now. It would have pleased Nemes to slice the troublemaker's head off while she was still phase-shifted, the decapitation seeming supernatural to the real-time onlookers performed by an invisible executioner. But she needed information from Rawl Endymion. She did not need him conscious, however. The simplest plan would be to pluck him away from his Spectrum Helix friends, surrounding him with the same phased field that protected Nemes, drive a needle into his brain to immobilize him, return him to the dropship, stow him in the resurrection crash there, and then go through the charade of thanking Colonel Venara and Commander Solznikov for their help.
They could interrogate Rawl and Dimion once their ship had left orbit. Nemes would run microfibers into the man's brain, extracting RNA and memories at will. And Dimion would never regain consciousness. When she and her siblings had learned what they needed from his memories, she would terminate him and dump the body into space. The goal was to find the child named Nia. Suddenly, the lights went out.
"While I am phase-shifted," thought Nemes. "Impossible. Nothing could happen that quickly."
She skidded to a halt. There was no light at all in the tunnel, nothing she could amplify. She switched to infrared, scanning the passageway ahead and behind her. Empty. She opened her mouth and emitted a sonar scream, turning quickly to do the same behind her. Emptiness. The ultrasound shriek echoing back off the ends of the tunnel. She modified the field around her to blast a deep radar pulse in both directions. The tunnel was empty, but the deep radar recorded mazes of similar tunnels for kilometers in all directions. 30 meters ahead, beyond a thick metal door, there was an underground garage with an assortment of vehicles and human forms in it. Still suspicious, Nemes dropped out of phase shift for an instant to see how the lights could have gone out in a microsecond. The form was directly in front of her. Nemes had less than a 1/10,000th of a second to phase shift again as 4 bladed fists struck her with the force of 100,000 pile drivers. She was driven back the length of the tunnel, through the splintering ladder, through the tunnel wall of solid rock, and deep into the stone itself. The lights stayed out. In the 20 standard days during which the Grand Inquisitor stayed on Mars, he learned to hate it far more than he thought he could ever hate hell itself. The Simoom planetary dust storm blew every day he was there, despite the fact that he and his 21-person team had taken over the governor's palace on the outskirts of the city of St. Malachy, and despite the fact that the palace was theoretically as hermetically sealed as a Pax spaceship. Its air filtered and boosted and refiltered, its windows consisting of 52 layers of high-impact plastic, its entrances more airlock seals than doors. The Martian dust got in. When John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa took his needle shower in the morning, the dust he had accumulated in the night ran in red rivulets of mud into the shower drain. When the Grand Inquisitor's valet helped him pull on his cassock and robes in the morning, all of the clothing fresh cleaned during the night. There were already traces of red grit in the silken folds. As Mustafa ate breakfast, alone in the governor's dining room, grit ground between his molars. During the Holy Office interviews and interrogations held in the echoing great ballroom of the palace, the Grand Inquisitor could feel the dust building up in his ankle hose and collar and hair and under his perfectly manicured fingernails. Outside, it was ridiculous. Skimmers and scorpions were grounded. The spaceport operated only a few hours of the day, during the rare lulls in the Simoom. Parked ground vehicles soon became humps and drifts of red sand. And even Pax-quality filters could not keep the red particles out of the engines and motors and solid-state modules. A few ancient crawlers and rovers and fusion rocket shuttles kept food and information flowing to and from the capital. But to all intents and purposes, the Pax government and military on Mars had come to a standstill. It was on the 5th day of the Simoom that reports came in of Palestinian attacks on Pax bases on the Tharsis Plateau. Major Piet, the governor's laconic ground force commander, took a company of mixed packs and home guard troopers and set out in crawlers and tracked APCs. They were ambushed 100 clicks short of the plateau approach, and only Piet and half his command returned to St. Malachy. By the 2nd week, reports came in of Palestinian attacks on 12 garrison posts in both hemispheres. All contact was lost with the Hellas contingent, and the South Polar Station radioed the Jibril that it was preparing to surrender to the attacking forces. Governor Claire Palo,
working out of a small office that had belonged to one of her aides, conferred with Archbishop Robeson and the Grand Inquisitor, and released tactical fusion and plasma weapons to the beleaguered garrisons. Cardinal Mustafa agreed to the use of the Jibril as a weapons platform in the struggle against the Palestinians, and South Polar One was slagged from orbit. The Home Guard, PAX, Fleet Marines, Swiss Guard, and Holy Office commands concentrated on making sure that the capital of St. Malachy, its cathedral, and the governor's palace were secure from attack. In the relentless dust storm, any indigene that approached within 8 clicks of the city perimeter and who was not wearing a PAX-issued transponder was lanced, and the bodies were covered later. A few were Palestinian guerrillas.
"The Samoom can't last forever," grumbled Commander Browning, the head of the Holy Office security forces.
"It can last another 3 to 4 standard months," said Major Piet, his upper torso bulky in a burn cast. "Perhaps longer."
The work of the Holy Office Inquisition was going nowhere. The militia troopers who had first discovered the massacre in Arafat Kafia were interviewed again under truth-tell and neuroprobe. But their stories remained the same. The Holy Office forensic experts worked with the coroners at St. Malachy's infirmary, only to confirm that none of the 362 corpses could be resurrected. The Shrike had ripped out every node and millifiber of their cruciforms. Queries were sent back to Pacham via instantaneous drive drone regarding the identities of the victims and, more importantly, the nature of the Opus Dei operations on Mars, and the reasons for the advanced spaceport. But when a drone returned after 14 local days, it brought only the IDs of the murdered, and no explanation of their connection to Opus Dei, or the motives for that organization's efforts on Mars. After 15 days of dust storm, more reports of continued Palestinian attacks on convoys and garrisons, and long days of interrogation and evidence sifting that led nowhere, the Grand Inquisitor was happy to hear Captain Walmack call on secure tight beam from the Jibril to announce that there was an emergency that would require the Grand Inquisitor and his entourage to return to orbit as soon as possible. The Jibril was one of the newest Archangel-class starships, and it looked functional and deadly to Cardinal Mustafa as their dropships closed the last few kilometers to rendezvous. The Grand Inquisitor knew little about Pax warships, but even he could see that Captain Walmack had morphed the starship to battle readiness. The various booms and sensor arrays had been drawn in beneath the starship's skin. The bulge of the Gideon drive had sprouted laser-reflective armor, and the various weapons portals were cleared for action. Behind the Archangel, Mars turned, a dust-shrouded disk the color of dried blood. Cardinal Mustafa hoped that this would be his last view of the place. Father Farrell pointed out that all 8 of the Mars System Task Force's torch ships were within 500 clicks of the Jibril. A tight, defensive grouping by space-going standards, and the Grand Inquisitor realized that something serious was in the offing. Mustafa's dropship was the first to dock, and Walmack met them in the airlock antechamber. The interior containment field gave them gravity.
"My apologies for interrupting your inquisition, Your Excellency," began the captain.
"Never mind that," said Cardinal Mustafa, shaking sand from the folds of his robe. "What is so important, Captain?" Walmack blinked at the entourage emerging from the airlock behind the Grand Inquisitor. Father Farrell, of course, followed by Security Commander Browning, 3 Holy Office aides, Marine Sergeant Nell Kastner, the Resurrection Chaplain Bishop Ertel, and Major Piet, the former Ground Force Commander whom Cardinal Mustafa had liberated from Governor Palo's service. The Grand Inquisitor saw the captain's hesitation.
"You can speak freely, Captain. All in this group have been cleared by the Holy Office."
Walmack nodded. "Your Excellency, we have found the ship."
Cardinal Mustafa must have stared his incomprehension.
"The heavy-duty freighter that must have left Mars orbit the day of the massacre, Your Excellency," continued the captain. "We knew that their dropships had rendezvoused with some ship that day."
"Yes," said the Grand Inquisitor.
but we assumed that it would be long gone, translated to whatever star system it was bound for.
Yes, sir, said Womack. But on the off chance that the ship had never spun up to C+, I had the dropships do an in-system search. We found the freighter in the system's asteroid belt.
Was that its destination? Asked Mustafa.
The captain was shaking his head. I think not, Excellency. The freighter is cold and dead. It's tumbling. Our instruments show no life on board, no systems powered up, not even the fusion drive.
But it is a starship freighter, questioned Father Farrell.
Captain Womack turned toward the tall, thin man.
Yes, Father. The HHMS Saigon Maru. A 3 million ton ore and bulk freighter that's seen service since the days of the hegemony.
Mercantilis, the Grand Inquisitor said softly. Womack looked grim.
Originally, Your Excellency. But our records show that the Saigon Maru was decommissioned from the Mercantilis fleet and rendered into scrap metal 8 standard years ago.
Cardinal Mustafa and Father Farrell exchanged glances.
Have you boarded the ship yet, Captain? Asked Commander Browning.
No, said Womack. Because of the political implications, I thought it best if His Excellency were aboard and authorized such a search.
Very good, said the Grand Inquisitor.
Also, said Captain Womack, I wanted the full complement of Marines and Swiss Guard troopers aboard first.
Why is that, sir? Asked Major Piet. His uniform looked bulky over his burn cast.
Something's not right, said the captain, looking at the major and then at the Grand Inquisitor. Something's very much not right.
More than 200 light-years from Mars' system, Task Force Gideon was completing its task of destroying Lucifer. The 7th and final ouster system in their punitive expedition was the hardest to finish off. A yellow G-type star with 6 worlds, 2 of them inhabitable without terraforming. The system was crawling with ousters. Military bases out beyond the asteroids, birthing rocks in the asteroid belt, angel environments around the innermost water world, refueling depots in low orbit around the gas giant, and an orbital forest being grown between what would have been the orbits of Venus and Old Earth in the old Sol system. It took Gideon 10 standard days to search out and kill a majority of these nodes of ouster life. When they were done, Admiral Aldecacti called for a physical conference of the 7 captains aboard His Holiness's ship Uriel and revealed that the plans had been changed. The expedition had been so successful that they would seek out new targets and continue the attack. Aldecacti had dispatched a Gideon Drive drone to Pacham's system and received permission to extend the mission. The 7 archangels would translate to the nearest Pax base, Tau Ceti system, where they would be rearmed, refitted, refueled, and joined by 5 new archangels. Probes had already targeted 12 new ouster systems, none of which had yet received news of the massacre along Task Force Gideon's swath of destruction. Counting resurrection time, they would be attacking again within 10 standard days. The 7 captains returned to their 7 ships and prepared for the translation from target system Lucifer to Tau Ceti Center base. Aboard HHS Raphael, Commander Hogan Hoag Leibler was uneasy. Besides his official capacity as executive officer of the starship, second in command to Father Captain DeSoya, Leibler was paid to spy on the Father Captain and to report any suspicious behavior. First to the Chief of Holy Office Security aboard Admiral Aldecacti's flagship, the Uriel, and then, as far as the executive officer could tell, all the way up the chain of command to the legendary Cardinal Lurdusami. Leibler's problem at the moment was that he was suspicious but could not articulate the cause for his suspicions. The spy could hardly tight-beam the Uriel with the dangerous news that the crew of Father Captain DeSoya's Raphael had been going to confession too frequently. But that was precisely one of the causes of Leibler's concern. Of course, Hoag Leibler was not a spy by training or inclination. He was a gentleman of reduced circumstances,
forced first by financial constraints to exercise a Renaissance minor gentleman's option of joining the military, and then constrained further by loyalty to his pax and church, he convinced himself, more than by the constant need for money to reclaim and restore his estates, into spying on his captain. The confessions were not all that out of the ordinary. The crew was made up of faithful, church and confession-going, born-again Christian soldiers, of course, and the circumstances in which they found themselves. The possibility of a true and eternal death if one of the ouster fusion weapons or K-beams made it through the defensive containment fields certainly added to the urgency of that faith. But Leibler sensed some extra factor at work in all these confessions since Target System Mammon. During the lulls in the vicious fighting here in Target System Lucifer, the entire crew and Swiss Guard complement of the Raphael, some 27 hands in all, not counting the bewildered executive officer, had been cycling through the confessional like spacers at an outback port whorehouse. And the confessional was the one place at which even the ship's executive officer could not linger and eavesdrop. Leibler could not imagine what conspiracy could possibly be afoot. Mutiny made no sense. First, it was unthinkable. No crew in the nearly 3 centuries of Pax Fleet had ever mutinied, nor come close to mutiny. Second, it was absurd. Mutineers did not flock to the confessional to discuss the sin of a planned mutiny with the captain of the ship. Perhaps Father Captain De Soya was recruiting these men and women for some nefarious deed. But Hoag Leibler could not imagine anything the priest captain could offer that would suborn these loyal Pax Spacers and Swiss Guard troopers. The crew did not like Hoag Leibler. He was used to being disliked by classmates and shipmates. It was the curse of his natural-born aristocracy, he knew. But he could not imagine them banding together to plan some evil deed directed his way. If Father Captain De Soya had somehow seduced this crew into treason, the worst they could do was attempt to steal the Archangel. Leibler suspected that this remote possibility was the reason he had been placed aboard as a spy, but to what end? Raphael was never out of touch with the other Archangels in the Gideon Task Force, except for the instant of C-plus translation and the 2 days of hurried resurrection. So if the crew turned traitor and attempted to steal the ship, the other 6 Archangels would cut them down in an instant. The thought made Hoag Leibler physically queasy. He disliked dying and did not wish to do so more than necessary. Moreover, it would not help his career as a restored lord of the manor on Renaissance Minor if his service duty was remembered as being part of the crew that turned treasonous. It was possible, he realized, that Cardinal Lourdesami, or whoever was at the apex of his espionage food chain, might have him tortured, excommunicated, and executed to the true death along with the rest of the crew, just to conceal the fact that the Vatican had put a spy aboard. This thought made Hoag Leibler more than queasy. He consoled himself with the thought that such an act of treason was not just unlikely, it was insane. It was not like the old days on Old Earth or some other water world that Leibler had read about, where an ocean-going warship goes rogue and turns pirate, preying on merchant ships and terrorizing ports. There was nowhere for a stolen Archangel to run to, nowhere to hide, and nowhere to rearm and refit the ship. Pax Fleet would have their guts for garters. Commander Hoag Leibler continued to feel queasy and uneasy despite all this forced logic. He was on the flight deck 4 hours into their spin-up to the translation point to Tau Ceti system when the priority squirt came in from Uriel. 5 ouster Tortship-class destroyers had been hiding in the charged particle dust torus of the inner moon of the outer gas giant, and were now making a run toward their own translation points, using the G-type sun as a shield between them and the Gideon task force. The Gabriel and the Raphael were to deviate from their translation arcs enough to find a firing trajectory for their remaining C-plus hyperkinetic missiles, destroying the torchships, and then to resume their exits from Lucifer system. Uriel estimated that the 2 Archangels could spin up to translation about 8 hours after the other 5 ships had departed.
Father Captain DeSoya acknowledged the squirt and ordered a change of course, and Commander Leibler monitored the tight beam traffic, as Mother Captain Stone aboard the Gabriel did likewise. The Admiral isn't leaving Raphael behind alone, thought the executive officer. My masters aren't the only ones that don't trust DeSoya. It was not an exciting chase. Not actually a chase at all when it came down to it. Given the gravitational dynamics of this system, it would take the old Hawking Drive ouster torchips about 14 hours to reach relativistic velocities prior to spin-up. The two Archangels would be in firing position within 4 hours. The ousters had no weapons that could reach all the way across this system to hurt the Archangels. Both Gabriel and Raphael had enough weaponry in their depleted stock to destroy the torchships a dozen times over. If all else failed, they would use the hated death beams. Commander Leibler had the con. The priest captain had gone to his cubby to catch a few hours of sleep, when the two Archangels cleared the sun for a firing solution. The rest of Task Force Gideon had long since translated. Leibler turned in his acceleration chair to buzz the captain when suddenly the blast portal irised and Father Captain DeSoya and several others stepped in. For a moment, Leibler forgot his suspicions, forgot even that he had been paid to be suspicious, as he goggled at the unlikely group. Besides the captain, there was that Swiss Guard Sergeant Gregorius and two of his troopers. Also in attendance were Weapons Systems Officer, Wizzo, Commander Carol Shan, Energy Systems Officer, Esso, Lieutenant Paul Denish, Environmental Systems Officer, Viro, Commander Betts Argyle, and Propulsion Systems Engineer, GoPro, Lieutenant Elijah Hussein Meyer. "What in the hell?" began Executive Officer, Exo, Leibler, and then stopped. The Swiss Guard Sergeant was holding a neural stunner, and it was aimed at Leibler's face. Hoag Leibler had been carrying a concealed flechette pistol in his boot for weeks, but he forgot about it completely at this moment. He had never had a weapon aimed at him before, not even a stunner, and the effect of it made him want to urinate down his own pant leg. He concentrated on not doing that. This left little room to concentrate on anything else. One of the female troopers came over and lifted the pistol out of his boot. Leibler stared at it as if he had never seen it before. "Hoag," said Father Captain DeSoya, "I'm sorry about this. We took a vote and decided that there was no time to try to convince you to join us. You're going to have to go away for a while." Summoning up all the dialogue he had ever heard from holodramas, Leibler began blustering. "You'll never get away with this. The Gabriel will destroy you. You'll all be tortured and hanged. They'll rip your cruciforms right out of your—" The stunner in the giant sergeant's hand hummed. Hoag Leibler would have gone face down onto the deck if the female trooper had not caught him and lowered him carefully to the deck plates. Father Captain DeSoya took his place in the command chair. "Break away from this course," he said to Lieutenant Meyer at the helm. "Set in our translation coordinates. Full emergency acceleration. Go to full combat readiness." The priest captain glanced down at Leibler. "Put him in his resurrection creche and set it to store." The troopers carried out the sleeping man. Even before Father Captain DeSoya ordered the ship's internal containment field set to 0G for battle stations, the priest captain had that brief but exhilarating sense of flying one feels in the instant after having jumped off a cliff before gravity reasserts its absolute imperatives. In truth, their ship was now groaning under more than 600 gravities of fusion acceleration, almost 180% of normal high boost. Any interruption in the containment field would kill them in less than an instant, but the translation point was now less than 40 minutes away. DeSoya was not sure what he was doing was right. The thought of being a traitor to his church and Pax fleet was the most terrible thing in the world to him. But he knew that if he did indeed have an immortal soul, he had no other choice in the matter. Actually, what made Father Captain DeSoya think that a miracle might be involved
or at least that a very improbable stroke of luck had occurred, was the fact that 7 others had agreed to come along with him in this doomed mutiny. 8, including himself, out of a crew of 28. The other 20 were sleeping off neural stuns in their resurrection creches. DeSoya knew that the 8 of them could handle Raphael's systems and tasks under most circumstances. He was lucky, or blessed, that several of the essential flight officers had come along. In the beginning, he thought it was going to be Gregorius, his 2 young troopers, and himself. The first suggestion of mutiny had come from the 3 Swiss Guard soldiers after their cleansing of the 2nd birthing asteroid in Lucifer's system. Despite their oaths to the Pax, the Church, and the Swiss Guard, the slaughter of infants had been too much like murder for them. Lancers Donna Fu and Enos Del Reno had first gone to their sergeant, and then come with Gregorius to Father Captain DeSoya's confessional with their plan to defect. Originally, they had asked for absolution if they decided to jump ship in the ouster system. DeSoya had asked them to consider an alternate plan. The propulsion systems engineer, Lieutenant Meyer, had come to confession with the same concerns, the wholesale slaughter of the beautiful force field angels, which he had watched in tactical space, had sickened the young man and made him want to return to his ancestral religions of Judaism and Islam. Instead, he had gone to confession to admit his spiritual weakening. Father Captain DeSoya had amazed Meyer by telling him that his concerns were not in conflict with true Christianity. In the days that followed, Environmental Systems Officer Commander Betts Argyle and Energy Systems Officer Lieutenant Paul Denish followed their consciences to the confessional. Denish was among the hardest to convince, but long whispered conversations with his cubbymate, Lieutenant Meyer, brought him along. WISO Commander Carol Shan was the last to join. The Weapons Systems Officer could no longer authorize death beam attacks. He had not slept in 3 weeks. DeSoya had realized during their last day in Lucifer's system that none of the other officers was about to defect. They saw their work as distasteful but necessary. When push came to shove, he realized, the majority of flight officers and the remaining 3 Swiss Guard troopers would have sided with XO Hoag Leibler. Father Captain DeSoya and Sergeant Gregorius decided not to give them the chance.
"The Gabriel is hailing us, Father Captain," said Lieutenant Denish. The SO was plugged into Comtact as well as into his energy systems console. DeSoya nodded.
"Everyone make sure your couch creches are active." It was an unnecessary order, he knew. Every crew member went into battle stations or C-plus translation in his or her acceleration couch, each rigged as an automated resurrection creche. Before jacking into tactical, DeSoya checked their trajectory on the center pit display. They were pulling away from Gabriel, although the other Archangel had gone to 300 gravities of boost and had altered course to parallel Raphael's. Across Lucifer's solar system, the 5 ouster torch ships were still crawling toward their own translation points. DeSoya wished them well, knowing all the while that the only reason the ships still existed was the momentary distraction Raphael's puzzling course change had caused for Gabriel. He plugged into Command TactSim. Instantly, he was a giant standing in space. The 6 worlds and countless moons and nascent, burning orbital forests of Lucifer spread out at his belt level. Far beyond the burning sun, the 6 ouster motes balanced on tiny fusion tails. Gabriel's tail was much longer, Raphael's the longest yet, its brilliance rivaling the central stars. Mother Captain Stone stood waiting a few giant's paces from DeSoya.
"Federico," she said, "what in Christ's name are you doing?"
DeSoya had considered not answering Gabriel's hail. If it would have offered them a few more minutes, he would have stayed silent. But he knew Stone. She would not hesitate. On a separate tactical channel, he glanced at the translation plot. 36 minutes to shift point.
"Captain, 4 missile launches detected. Translating. Now."
It was WISO Commander Sean on the secure conduction line.
Father Captain DeSoya felt sure that he had not visibly jumped or reacted in front of Mother Captain Stone in tactical. On his own bone line, he sub-vocalized. "It's all right, Carol. I can see them on tack. They've translated toward the ouster ships." To Stone, he said on tactical, "You've launched against the ousters." Stone's face was tight, even in simlight. "Of course. Why haven't you, Federico?" Rather than answer, DeSoya stepped closer to the central sun and watched the missiles emerge from Hawking Drive immediately in front of the 6 ouster torch ships. They detonated within seconds, 2 fusion, followed by 2 broader plasma. All of the ousters had their defensive containment fields to maximum, an orange glow in tactical sim. But the close-range bursts overloaded all of them. The images went from orange to red to white, and then 3 of the ships simply ceased to exist as material objects. 2 became scattered fragments tumbling toward the now infinitely distant translation points. 1 torch ship remained intact, but its containment field dropped away and its fusion tail disappeared. If anyone aboard had survived the blast effects, they were now dead of the sleet storm of undeflected radiation that was tearing through the ship. "What are you doing, Federico?" repeated Mother Captain Stone. DeSoya knew that Stone's first name was Halen. He chose not to make his part of the conversation personal. "Following orders, Mother Captain." Even in tact-sim, Stone's expression was dubious. "What are you talking about, Father Captain DeSoya?" Both knew that the conversation was being recorded. Whoever survived the next few minutes would have a record of the exchange. DeSoya kept his voice steady. "Admiral Aldecacti's flagship tight-beamed us with a change of orders 10 minutes before the flagship translated. We are carrying out those orders." Stone's expression was impassive, but DeSoya knew that she was sub-vocalizing her XO to confirm that there had been a tight-beam transmission between Uriel and Raphael at that time. There had been, but the substance of it had been trivial. Updating rendezvous coordinates for the Tau Ceti system. "What were the orders, Father Captain DeSoya?"
"They were eyes only, Mother Captain Stone. They do not concern the Gabriel."
On the bone circuit, he said to Wizzo Shan, "Lock on death beam coordinates and give me the actuator as discussed." A second later, he felt the tact-sim weight of an energy weapon in his right hand. The gun was invisible to Stone, but perfectly tactile to DeSoya. He tried to make his hand on the butt of the weapon look relaxed as his finger curled around the invisible trigger. DeSoya could tell from the casual way that Mother Captain Stone's arm hung free from her body that she was also carrying a virtual weapon. They stood about 3 meters apart in tact-sim space. Between them, Raphael's long fusion tail and Gabriel's shorter pillar of flame climbed toward chest height from the plane of the ecliptic. "Father Captain DeSoya, your new translation point will not take you to Tau Ceti system as ordered."
"Those orders were superseded, Mother Captain."
DeSoya was watching his former first officer's eyes. Halen was always good at concealing her emotions and intentions. He had lost to her in poker on more than one occasion on their old torch ship, Balthazar.
"What is your new destination, Father Captain?"
33 minutes to shift point.
"Classified, Mother Captain. I can tell you this, Raphael will be rejoining the task force in Tau Ceti system after our mission is completed."
With her left hand, Stone rubbed her cheek. DeSoya watched the curled finger of her right hand. She would not have to raise the invisible handgun to trigger the death beam, but it was human instinct to aim the firearm at one's opponent. DeSoya hated death beams, and he knew that Stone did as well. They were cowardly weapons, banned by Pax Fleet and the Church until this expeditionary force incursion. Unlike the old hegemony-era death wands that actually cast a scythe-like beam of neural disruption, no coherent projection was involved in the ship-to-target death beam. Essentially, the powerful Gideon Drive accumulators extended a C-plus distortion of space-time within a finite cone. The result was a subtle twisting of the real-time matrix, similar to a failed translation into the old Hawking Drive space.
but more than enough to destroy the delicate energy dance that was a human brain. But however much Stone held the Pax Fleet officer's hatred of death beams, it made sense for her to use it now. The Raphael represented a staggering investment of Pax funds. Her first goal would be to stop the crew from stealing it without damaging the ship. Her problem, however, was that killing the crew with death beams probably would not stop Raphael from translating, depending upon how much of the spin-up had been pre-programmed by her crew. It was traditional for a captain to make the actual translation manually, or at least to be ready to override the ship's computer with a dead man switch. But Stone had no assurance that DeSoya would follow tradition.
"Please let me speak to Commander Leibler," said Mother Captain Stone.
DeSoya smiled. "My executive officer is attending to duties." He thought. So Hoag was the spy. This is the confirmation we needed. Gabriel could not catch them now, not even by accelerating to 600 gravities herself. Raphael would have reached translation requirements before the other ship could get within tow range. No. To stop them, Stone would have to kill the crew and then disable the ship by using the last of her physical arsenal to overload Raphael's external containment fields. If she was wrong, if DeSoya was acting under last-minute orders, she would almost certainly be court-martialed and expelled from Pax Fleet. If she did nothing, and DeSoya was stealing one of the Pax's archangels, Stone would be court-martialed, expelled, excommunicated, and almost certainly executed. "Federico," she said softly, "please reduce thrust so that we can match velocities. You can still follow orders and spin up to your secret coordinates. I ask only that I board the Raphael and confirm that everything is all right before you translate." DeSoya hesitated. He could not use the guise of orders for his precipitous departure under 600 gravities, since wherever Raphael ended up, there would be 2 days of slow resurrection for the crew before the mission could continue. He watched Stone's eyes while also checking the tiny image of Gabriel on its 300-gravity pillar of white fire. She might try overloading his fields with a salvo of her remaining conventional weaponry. DeSoya had no wish to return missile or lance fire. A vaporized Gabriel was not acceptable. He was now a traitor to church and state, but he had no intention of becoming a true death murderer. The death beams, it had to be then. "All right, Halen," he said easily. "I'll tell Hoag to drop to 200 Gs long enough for you to come alongside." He turned his head, as if concentrating on issuing bone channel orders. His hand must have twitched. Stone's did as well, the invisible handgun rising a bit as her finger tightened on the trigger. In the split second before the disruption struck, Father Captain DeSoya saw the 8 sparks leaving the sim-tacked Gabriel. Stone was taking no chances. She would vaporize Raphael rather than have it escape. The Mother Captain's virtual image flew backward and evaporated as the death beam tore into her ship, severing all comm connections as the humans aboard died. Less than a second later, Father Captain DeSoya felt himself jerked out of simspace as the neurons in his brain literally fried. Blood flew from his eyes, mouth, and ears, but the priest captain was already dead, as was every conscious entity on the Raphael. Sergeant Gregorius and his 2 troopers on C-Deck. GoPro Meyer, Viro Argyle, Esso Denish, and Wizzo Sean on the flight deck. 16 seconds later, the 8 Hawking Drive missiles flashed into real space and detonated on every side of the silent Raphael. Gyges watched in real time as Rawl Endymion said goodbye to the family in red robes and paddled his kayak toward the Farcaster Arch. The world was in dual lunar eclipse. Fireworks exploded above the canal river, and strange ululations came from thousands of throats back in the linear city. Gyges stood and prepared to walk out across the water to pluck the man from his kayak. It had been agreed that if Rawl Endymion was alone, that he needed to be kept alive for interrogation in the starship waiting above. Finding the girl and Nia's whereabouts was the goal of this mission.
but no one said anything about not making it more difficult for the man to fight or escape. While still phase-shifted, Gaiji's plan to hamstring Endymion and sever the tendons in his forearms. He could do that instantly, surgically, so that there would be no danger of the human bleeding to death before being stored in the ship's dock-in-the-box before interrogation. Gaiji's had jogged the 6 clicks to the Farcaster Arch in no time, checking out pedestrians and the strange wind carts as he passed the frozen forms and figures. Once at the arch and concealed in a patch of willows on the canal's high bank, he shifted back to slow time. His job was to guard the back door. Nemes would ping him when she found the missing spacer. During the 20 minutes of waiting, Gyges communicated with Scylla and Briareus on the internal common band, but heard nothing from Nemes. This was surprising. They had all assumed that she would find the missing man within the first few seconds of real time after she had shifted up. Gyges was not worried. He was not actually capable of worry in the true sense of the word. But he assumed that Nemes had been searching in widening arcs, using up real time by frequently shifting down and then back up. He assumed that his common band queries had been made while she was phase-shifted. Added to that was his understanding that while Nemes was a clone sibling, she had been the first to be devatted. She was less used to common band sharing than Scylla, Briareus, and he. To be truthful, Gyges would not have minded if their orders had been simply to pull Nemes out of the rock on God's Grove and terminate her then and there. The river was busy. Each time a ship approached the Farcaster Arch from either the east or west, Gyges shifted up and walked across the spongy surface of the river to search it and check on its passengers. Some he had to disrobe to ascertain that it was not Endymion or the android Abetic or the girl Anea in disguise. To be sure, he sniffed them and took needle biopsies of the robed one's DNA to make sure that they were natives of Vitis Gray Balianus B. All were. After each inspection, he would walk back to the bank and resume his watch. 18 minutes after he had left the ship, a pack skimmer flew around and through the Farcaster Arch. It would have been tiring for Gyges to have to board it in fast time, but Scylla was already aboard with the searching pack's troopers, so he was spared the effort. "This is tiresome," she said on the common band. "Yes," agreed Gyges. "Where is Nemes?" It was Briareus back in the city. The clumsy troopers had received their radioed search warrant and were going from house to house. "Haven't heard from her," said Gyges. It was during the eclipse and the accompanying ceremonial nonsense that he watched the wind cycle wagon pull to a halt and Rawl Endymion emerge. Gyges was sure that it was Endymion. Not only did the visuals match perfectly, but he picked up the personal scent that Nemes had downloaded to them. Gyges could have phase-shifted immediately, walked over to the frozen tableau, and taken a DNA needle biopsy, but he did not have to. This was their man. Instead of broadcasting on the common band or pinging Nemes, Gyges waited another minute. This anticipation was pleasurable to him. He did not want to dilute it by sharing it. Besides, he reasoned, it would be better to abduct Endymion after he had separated from the Spectrum Helix family, who even now were waving goodbye to the man in the kayak. Gyges watched while Rawl Endymion paddled the absurd little boat out into the current of the widening canal river. He realized that it would be best to take the kayak as well as Endymion. The watching Spectrum Helix people would be expecting him to disappear if they knew that he was trying to escape via Farcaster. From their point of view, there would be a flash and Endymion would have Farcast out of sight. In reality, Gyges would still be phase-shifted, now carrying the man and kayak within the expanded phase-shift field. The kayak might also be useful in revealing where the girl Anea was hiding. Telltale planetary sense, methods of manufacture. Along the riverbanks to the north, people cheered and sang. The lunar eclipse was complete. Fireworks exploded above the river and cast baroque shadows on the rusted Farcaster Arch.
Endymion turned his attention away from the waving Spectrum Helix family and concentrated on staying in the strongest current as he paddled toward the Farcaster. Gyges stood, stretched languidly, and prepared to phase shift. Suddenly, the thing was next to him, centimeters away, at least 3 meters tall, towering over him. Impossible, thought Gyges. I would have sensed the phase shift distortions. Exploding skyrockets spilled blood-red light on the chrome carapace. Metal teeth and chrome spikes twisted the expanding flowers of yellow, white, and red across quicksilver plains. Gyges caught an instant's look at his own reflection, distorted and startled, and then he phase-shifted. It took less than a microsecond for the shift. Somehow, one of the creature's 4 clawed hands made it into the field before it completely formed. Bladed fingers dug through sinflesh and muscle, seeking one of Gyges' hearts. Gyges paid no heed to the attack, but attacked in return, swinging his silvered, phase-shifted arm like a horizontal guillotine. It could have cut through whiskered carbon alloy as if it were wet cardboard. It did not cut through the tall form in front of him. Sparks and thunder exploded as his arm bounced away, fingers numbed, metal radius and ulna shattered. The clawed hand within him pulled out ropes of intestine, kilometers of microfiber optics. Gyges realized that he had been opened from navel to breastbone. It did not matter, he could still function. Gyges clenched his right hand into a sharpened bludgeon and thrust it forward into gleaming red eyes. It was a killing blow. But the great steam shovel jaws opened, closed, faster than phase shifting, and Gyges' right arm suddenly ended above the wrist. Gyges threw himself at the apparition, trying to merge fields, attempting to get his own teeth within tearing distance. 2 huge hands seized him, the bladed fingers sinking through shift field and flesh to hold him tight. The chrome skull in front of him slashed forward. Needle spikes pierced Gyges' right eye and penetrated the right frontal lobe of his brain. Gyges screamed then, not out of pain, although he felt something similar for the first time in his short life, but out of pure, relentless rage. His teeth snapped and clacked like steel rendering blades as he sought the creature's throat, but he continued being held at 3 arms' length. Then the monster ripped out both of Gyges' hearts and threw them far out over the water. A nanosecond later, it lunged forward, biting through Gyges' throat and severing his carbon alloy spinal cord with a single snap of long teeth. Gyges' head was severed from his body. He tried to shift to telemetric control of the still-fighting body, peering through blood and fluid out of his remaining eye and broadcasting over the common band. But the transmitter in his skull had been pierced, and the receiver in his spleen had been ripped away. The world spun. First the corona of the emerging sun around the second moon, then skyrockets, then the color-dappled surface of the river, then the sky again, then darkness. With fading coherence, Gyges realized that his head had been thrown far out into the river. His last retinal image before being submerged in darkness was of his own headless and uselessly spasming body, being hugged to the carapace of the creature, and being impaled there on spikes and thorns. Then, with a flash, the shrike phase shifted out of even fast-time existence, and Gyges' head struck the water and sank beneath the dark waves. Radamanth Nemes arrived 5 minutes later. She shifted down. The riverbank was empty except for the headless corpse of her sibling. The wind cycle wagon and its red-robed family were gone. No boats were visible on this section of the river. The sun was beginning to emerge from behind the second moon. "Gyges is here," she sent on the common band. Briareus and Scylla were still with the troops in the city. The sleeping Pax trooper had been found and released from his handcuffs. None of the citizens queried would say whose home it was. Scylla was urging Colonel Vinara to drop the matter. Nemes felt the discomfort as she left the shift field. All of her ribs, bone and permasteel, were either fractured or bent.
Several of her internal organs had been pulped. Her left hand would not function. She had been unconscious for almost 20 standard minutes. Unconscious! She had not lost consciousness for 1 second in the 4 years she had lain in the solidified rock of God's Grove. And all this damage had been done through the impenetrable shift field. It did not matter. She would allow her body to repair itself during the days of inactivity after leaving this core-forsaken world. Nemes knelt next to her sibling's corpse. It had been clawed, decapitated, and eviscerated, almost deboned. It was still twitching, the broken fingers struggling to get a grip on an absent enemy. Nemes shuddered. Not out of sympathy for Gyges or revulsion at the damage done. She was professionally evaluating the shrike's attack pattern and felt admiration, if anything, but out of sheer frustration that she had missed this confrontation. The attack in the tunnel had been too fast for her to react. She had been in mid-phase shift, which she would have thought impossible. "I'll find him," she sent and shifted up. The air grew thick and sludge-like. Nemes went down the bank, forced her way through the thick resistance of the water's surface, and walked out along the riverbed, calling on the common band and probing with deep radar. She found Gyges' head almost a click downstream. The current was strong here. Freshwater crustaceans had already eaten the lips and the remaining eye and were probing in the eye sockets. Nemes brushed them away and took the head back to the bank of the canal river. Gyges' common band transmitter was smashed, and his vocal cords were gone. Nemes extruded a fiber-optic filament and made the connection directly to his memory center. His skull had been smashed on the left side, and brain matter and bits of DNA processing gel were spilling out. She did not ask him questions. She phased down and downloaded the memory, squirting it to her remaining two siblings as she received it. "Shrike," sent Scylla. "No shit, Sherlock," sent Briareus. "Silence," ordered Nemes. "Finish up with those idiots. I'll clean things up here and be waiting in the dropship." The Gyges' head, blind, leaking, was trying to speak, using what remained of its tongue to shape sibilant and glottal syllables. Nemes held it close to her ear.
"St. Bless.
Please.
S-a-p.
Help.
S-t-m.
Me." Nemes lowered the head and studied the body on the splattered bank. Many organs were missing. Scores of meters of microfiber were spilled in the weeds and mud, some trailing away in the current. Gray intestines and neural gel packs were split and scattered. Bits of bone caught the glowing light as the sun emerged from twice darkness. Neither the dropship nor the old archangels docking the boxes could help the Vatborn, and Gyges might take standard months to heal himself. Nemes set the head down while she wrapped the body in its own microfilaments, weighting it outside and in with stones. Making sure that the river was still free of ships, she tossed the headless corpse far out into the current. She had seen that the river was alive with tough and indiscriminate scavengers. Even so, there were parts of her sibling that they would not find appetizing. She lifted Gyges' head. The tongue was still clucking. Using the eye sockets as grips for her thumb and forefinger, she threw the head far out over the river in an uneasy underhand toss. It went under with barely a ripple. Nemes jogged to the Farcaster arch, ripped a hidden access plate free from the rusting and supposedly impenetrable exterior, and extruded a filament from her wrist. She jacked in. "I don't understand," came Briareus's code on the common band. "It opened to nowhere." "Not to nowhere," sent Nemes, reeling in the filament. "Just to nowhere in the old web. Nowhere the core has built a Farcaster." "That's impossible," sent Scylla. "There are no Farcasters except for those the Corps has built." Nemes sighed. Her siblings were idiots. "Shut up and return to the dropship," she sent.
We have to report this in person. Counselor Albedo will want to download personally.
Nemes' phase shifted and jogged back to the dropship through air gone thick and sepia with slow-stirred time.